And if you want to start a program, be your own scientist. Test things out. Start low. Build slow. Make your own observations. And have a frame of reference for healing. If you've been sickening for years and decades, it's so unrealistic that somebody's going to give you a pill or a procedure or an IV and you're going to get better in 2 weeks. That's not how it happens. Years of inflammation and fermentation create years of layers of junk like an onion, and you have to peel them off layer by layer. And what is the reward? A reward is enlightenment for the rest of your life. Reward is a love for truth for the rest of your life. The reward is freedom from all these hucksters who are advertising, and they are very slick, and they know how to move you. Whether you're talking about hair loss, or you're talking about rough, dry skin, or you're talking about eczema, or you're talking about acne, those are secondary issues. This has been Science, Health, and Again. This has been, this is, of course, WBI.org. You can listen to these programs online. Please become a WBI buddy. Please contribute to the ongoing health of this organization called WBI. And until we meet again, may you be gracious, graceful, and generous in your spirit. Good night.
And Science, Health, and Healing can be heard every Wednesday evening from 11 to 12 with Dr. Majid Ali here on WBAI New York. Coming up at 1:30 this morning, Hour of the Wolf, Jim Freund celebrates renowned comic book and science fiction writer Alfie Bester on tonight's program. So stick around. Lister follows at 3 a.m. here in the home of the hits, WBAI New York. Coming up in a minute or so, Earthwatch with Robert Knight. So please, stay tuned.
The WBAI Community Advisory Board will be holding open meetings at the station's office at 388 Atlantic Avenue in Brooklyn every Sunday. These meetings will begin at 1 p.m. and will include discussions of the latest developments concerning the lease management agreement issue and your idea on programming. The meetings will be on every Sunday starting at 1 p.m. Again, WBAI's Community Advisory Board will be holding meetings at 388 Atlantic Avenue at 1 p.m. at the WBAI office at 388 Atlantic Avenue in Brooklyn starting at 1 p.m. Expect to work and help with the station needs. With your help, we will get through this. All are welcome and invited to come and participate.
Thank you, Max Schmid. This is WBAI in New York, broadcasting at 99.5 MHz FM and streaming at stream.wbai.org. My name is Robert Knight, welcoming you to a very special edition of Earthwatch, celebrating the actual, real, and true birthday as of January 15th, 2014, the 85th birthday of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr. And in this program, we will hear some seminal prophecies of the great Dr. King. Stay tuned. This is Earthwatch.
The bell for freedom still rings. The bell for freedom still rings. Sorrow to me, but does it ring to know the bell of freedom still rings? The hammer for justice still pounds. The hammer for justice still pounds. Heavy is the beating sound of the hammer for justice that comes. When the world up and see. When will we feel what we've been missing? That the man in the moon must have found, 'cause he looks upon us with a frown, to know that me and the baby still starve. Me and the baby still starve. We can't have the biggest heart if me and the baby still starve. And the innocent one still died. The innocent one still died. We can't value life too high if the innocent one still dies. When will the world stop enlisting? When will we all stop and see? We've been missing, that the man in the moon must have found, 'cause he looks upon us with a frown. Light of truth we won't let shine, light of truth we won't let shine. Tell me, has the world gone blind? Light of truth we won't let shine. Long as there's life, there's still a day. Long as there's life, there's still a day. And I know that we can find our way. For as long as there's life, there's still a day.
Greetings, and welcome to this special edition of Earthwatch on the Pacifica Radio Network, originating at WBAI, celebrating the 85th birthday of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr. I'm Robert Knight in New York, and in today's program, we review one of the lesser-repeated speeches of Dr. King, addressing the economic underpinnings of American racism. The Other America was presented in various forms to the communities of Stanford, California, and Grosse Pointe, Michigan, near Detroit, during the last 2 years of Dr. King's life in 1967 and 68, that was simultaneous with his pioneering transformation of the civil rights movement into one of anti-war militancy and economic justice. We shall also hear today about King's contemporary relevance during a recent interview with Kevin Gray, the author of Waiting for Lightning to Strike, The Fundamentals of Black Politics, as well as The Decline of Black Politics, From Malcolm X to Barack Obama. Also on deck, Dr. King's final comprehensive address of 1967 to the SCLC, the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. But first, we hear Dr. King speaking, among other things, about the academic of double the average black unemployment in America in this political season in which the Obama administration and congressional Democrats abandoned the nation's working class by dropping an economy-boosting extension to unemployment during the Democratic Party's budget negotiations, or might we say surrender, to the persistent reactionary economic and racialist forces in America about whom Dr. King spoke so eloquently more than 45 years ago. This is Earthwatch. I'm Robert Knight. And here now, the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr. in his seminal address, The Other America.
Now, there are several things that one could talk about before such a large, concerned, and enlightened audience. There are so many problems facing our nation and our world that one could just take off anywhere. But today I would like to talk mainly about the race problem, since I'll have to rush right out and go to New York to talk about Vietnam tomorrow, and I've been talking about it a great deal this week and weeks before that. But I'd like to use as a subject from which to speak this afternoon the other America. And I use this subject because there are literally two Americas. One America is beautiful for situation. And in a sense, this America is overflowing with the milk of prosperity and the honey of opportunity. This America is the habitat of millions of people who have food and material necessities for their bodies, and culture and education for their minds, and freedom and human dignity for their spirits. In this America, millions of people experience every day the opportunity of having life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness in all of their dimensions. And in this America, millions of young people grow up in the sunlight of opportunity. But tragically and unfortunately, there is another America. And this other America has a daily ugliness about it that constantly transforms the buoyancy of hope into the fatigue of despair. In this America, millions of work-starved men walk the streets daily in search for jobs that do not exist. In this America, millions of people find themselves living in rat-infested, vermin-filled slums. In this America, people are poor by the millions, and they find themselves perishing on a lonely island of poverty in the midst of a vast ocean of material prosperity. In a sense, the greatest tragedy of this other America is what it does to little children. Little children in this other America are forced to grow up with clouds of inferiority forming every day in their little mental skies. And as we look at this other America, we see it as an arena of blasted hopes and shattered dreams. People of various backgrounds live in this American. Some are Puerto Ricans, some happen groups. Probably the largest group in this size in the population is the American Negro. The American Negro finds himself living in a triple ghetto. A ghetto of race, a ghetto of poverty, a ghetto of human misery. So what we are seeking to do in the civil rights movement is to deal with this problem, to deal with this problem of the two Americas. We are seeking to make America one nation, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. Now let me say that the struggle for civil rights, or the struggle to make these two Americas one America, is much more difficult today than it was 5 or 10 years ago. For about a decade, or maybe 12 years, we struggled all across the South in glorious struggles to get rid of legal, overt segregation and all of the humiliation that surrounded that system of segregation. In a sense, this was a struggle for decency. We could not go to a lunch counter in so many instances and get a hamburger or a cup of coffee. We could not make use of public accommodations. Public transportation was segregated, and often we had to sit in the back, and within transportation within cities, we often had to stand over empty seats because sections were reserved for whites only. We did not have the right to vote in so many areas of the South. And the struggle was to deal with these problems. Now, certainly they were difficult problems. They were humiliating conditions. And by the thousands, we protested these conditions. And we made it clear that it was ultimately more honorable to accept jail cell experiences than to accept segregation and humiliation. By the thousands, students and adults decided to sit in at segregated lunch counters to protest conditions there. And when they were sitting at those lunch counters, they were in reality standing up for the best in the American dream and seeking to take the whole nation back to those great wells of democracy, which were dug deep by the founding fathers in the formulation of the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence. Many things were gained as a result of these years of struggle. In 1964, the Civil Rights Bill came into being after the Birmingham movement, which did a great deal to subpoena the conscience of a large segment of the nation to appear before the judgment seat of morality on the whole question of civil rights. After the Selma movement in 1965, we were able to get a voting rights bill. Now, all of these things represented strides, but we must see that the struggle today is much more difficult. It's more difficult today because we are struggling now for genuine equality. And it's much easier to integrate a lunch counter than it is to guarantee a livable income and a good solid job. It's much easier to guarantee the right to vote than it is to guarantee the right to live in sanitary, decent housing conditions. It is much easier to integrate a public park than it is to make genuine, quality, integrated education a reality. And so today we are struggling for something which says we demand genuine equality. It's not merely a struggle against extremist behavior toward Negroes. And I'm convinced that many of the very people who supported us in the struggle in the South are not willing to go all the way now. I came to see this in a very difficult and painful way in Chicago over the last year where I've lived and worked. Some of the people who came quickly to march with us in Selma and Birmingham were active around Chicago. And I came to see that so many people who supported morally and even financially what we were doing in Birmingham and Selma were really outraged against the extremist behavior of Bull Connor and Jim Clark toward Negroes rather than believing in genuine equality for Negroes. And I think this is what we've got to see now, and this is what makes the struggle much more difficult. And so as a result of all of this, we see many problems existing today that are growing more difficult. It's something that is often overlooked. But Negroes generally live in worse slums today than 20 or 25 years ago. In the North, schools are more segregated today than they were in 1954 when the Supreme Court's decision on desegregation was rendered. Economically, the Negro is worse off today than he was 15 and 20 years ago. And so the unemployment rate among whites at one time was about the same as the unemployment rate among Negroes. But today the unemployment rate among Negroes is twice that of whites. And the average income of the Negro is today 50% less than whites. And as we look at these problems, we see them growing and developing every day. We see the fact that the Negro economically is facing a depression in his everyday life that is more staggering than the depression of the 30s. The unemployment rate of the nation as a whole is about 4%. Statistics would say from the Labor Department that among Negroes it's about 8.4%. But these are the persons who are in the labor market, who still go to employment agencies to seek jobs, and so they can be calculated. The statistics can be gotten because they are still somehow in the labor market. But there are hundreds of thousands of Negroes who have given up. They've lost hope. They've come to feel that life is a long and desolate corridor for them with no exit sign. And so they no longer go to look for a job. There are those who would estimate that these persons who are called the discouraged persons would be 6 or 7% in the Negro community. And that means that unemployment among Negroes may well be 16%. And among Negro youth in some of our large urban areas, it goes to 30% and 40%. And so you can see what I mean when I say that in the Negro community, that is a major, tragic, and staggering depression that we face in our everyday lives. Now the other thing that we've got to come to see now that many of us didn't see too well during the last 10 years, that is that racism is still alive in American society and much more widespread than we realize. And we must see racism for what it is. It is a myth of the superior and the inferior race. It is the false and tragic notion that one particular group, one particular race is responsible for all of the progress, all of the insights and the total flow of history, and the theory that another group or another race is totally depraved, innately impure, and innately inferior. In the final analysis, racism is evil because its ultimate logic is genocide. Hitler was a sick and tragic man who carried racism to its logical conclusion. And he ended up leading a nation to the point of killing about 6 million Jews. And this is the tragedy of racism because its ultimate logic is genocide. If one says that I am not good enough to live next door to him, if one says that I am not good enough to eat at a lunch counter, or to have a good, decent job, or to go to school with him merely because of my race, he is saying consciously or unconsciously that I do not deserve to exist. To use a philosophical analogy here, racism is not based on some empirical generalization. It is based rather on an ontological affirmation. It is not the assertion that certain people are behind culturally or otherwise because of environmental conditions. It is the affirmation that the very being of a people is inferior. And this is the great tragedy of it. I say that however unpleasant it is, we must honestly see and admit that racism is still deeply rooted all over America. America has been backlashing on the whole question of basic constitutional and God-given rights for Negroes and other disadvantaged groups for more than 300 years. So these conditions, persistence of widespread poverty, of slums, and of tragic conditions in schools and other areas of life, all of these things have brought about a great deal of despair and a great deal of desperation, a great deal of disappointment and even bitterness in the Negro communities. And today all of our cities confront huge problems. All of our cities are potentially powder kegs as a result of the continued existence of these conditions. Many in moments of anger, many in moments of deep bitterness, engage in riots. Let me say, as I've always said, and I will always continue to say, that riots are socially destructive and self-defeating. I'm still convinced that nonviolence is the most potent weapon available to oppress people in their struggle for freedom and justice. I feel that violence will only create more social problems than they will solve. That in a real sense it is impractical for the Negro to even think of mounting a violent revolution in the United States. So I will continue to condemn riots and continue to say to my brothers and sisters that this is not the way. Continue to affirm that there is another way. But at the same time, it is as necessary for me to be as vigorous in condemning the conditions which cause persons to feel that they must engage in riotous activities as it is for me to condemn riots. I think America must see that riots do not develop out of thin air. Certain conditions continue to exist in our society, which must be condemned as vigorously as we condemn riots. But in the final analysis, a riot is the language of the unheard. What is it that America has failed to hear? It has failed to hear that the plight of the Negro poor has worsened over the last few years. It has failed to hear that the promises of freedom and justice have not been met, and it has failed to hear that large segments of white society are more concerned about tranquility and the status quo than about justice, equality, and humanity. And so in a real sense, our nation's summers of riots are caused by our nation's winters of delay. And as long as America postpones justice, we stand in the position of having these recurrences of violence and riots over and over again. Social justice and progress are the absolute guarantors of riot prevention. Now let me go on to say that if we are to deal with all of the problems that I've talked about, that we are to bring America to the point that we have one nation, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all, there are certain things that we must do. The job ahead must be massive and positive. We must develop massive action programs all over the United States of America in order to deal with the problems that I have mentioned. Now, in order to develop these massive action programs, we've got to get rid of one or two false notions that continue to exist in our society. One is the notion that only time can solve the problem of racial injustice. I'm sure you've heard this idea. It is the notion almost that is something in the very flow of time that will miraculously cure all evils. And I've heard this over and over again. There are those, and they're often sincere people, who say to Negroes and their allies in the white community that we should slow up and just be nice and patient and continue to pray, and in 100 or 200 years the problem will work itself out, because only time can solve the problem. Well, I think that is an answer to that myth, and it is that time is neutral. It can be used either constructively or destructively. And I'm absolutely convinced that the forces of ill will in our nation, the extreme righteous in our nation, have often used time much more effectively than the forces of goodwill. And it may well be that we will have to repent in this generation, not merely for the vitriolic words of the bad people and the violent actions of the bad people, but for the appalling silence and indifference of the good people who sit around and say, wait on time. Somewhere we must come to see that social progress never rolls in on the wheels of inevitability. It comes through the tireless efforts and the persistent work of dedicated individuals. And without this hard work, time itself becomes an ally of the primitive forces of social stagnation. And so we must help time, and we must realize that the time is always right to do right. Now, that's another notion that gets out. It's around everywhere. It's in the South, it's in the North, it's in California, and all over our nation. It's a notion that legislation can't solve the problem, it can't do anything in this area. And those who project this argument contend that you've got to change the heart, and that you can't change the heart through legislation. Now, I would be the first one to say that there is real need for a lot of heart changing in our country. And I believe in changing the heart. I preach about it. I believe in the need for conversion in many instances, and regeneration, to use theological terms. And I would be the first to say that if the race problem in America is to be solved, the white person must treat the Negro right, not merely because the law says it, but because it's natural, because it's right, and because the Negro is his brother. And so I realize that if we are to have a truly integrated society, men and women will have to rise to the majestic heights of being obedient to the unenforceable. But after saying this, let me say another thing which gives the other side, and that is that although it may be true that morality cannot be legislated, behavior can be regulated. Even though it may be true that the law cannot change the heart, it can restrain the heartless. Even though it may be true that the law cannot make a man love me, it can restrain him from lynching me. And I think that's pretty important also. And so while the law may not change the hearts of men, it can and it does change the habits of men. And when you begin to change the habits of men, pretty soon the attitudes will be changed. Pretty soon the hearts will be changed. Now, I'm convinced that we still need strong civil rights legislation. And there's a bill before Congress right now to have a national, a federal open housing bill, a federal law declaring discrimination in housing unconstitutional, and also a bill to make the administration of justice real all over our country. Now, nobody can doubt the need for this. Nobody can doubt the need if he thinks about the fact that Since 1963, some 50 Negroes and white civil rights workers have been brutally murdered in the state of Mississippi alone. Not a single person has been convicted for these dastardly crimes. There have been some indictments, but no one has been convicted. And so there is a need for a federal law dealing with the whole question of the administration of justice. There is a need for fair housing laws all over our country. And it is tragic indeed that Congress last year allowed this bill to die. And that bill died in Congress. A bit of democracy died. A bit of our commitment to justice died. And if it happens again in this session of Congress, a greater degree of our commitment to democratic principles will die. The civil rights movement must now begin to organize for the guaranteed annual income, begin to organize people all over our country and mobilize forces so that we can bring to the attention of our nation this need and this something which I believe will go a long, long way toward dealing with the Negro's economic problem and the economic problem with many other poor people confronting our nation. Now, I said I wasn't going to talk about Vietnam, but I can't make a speech without mentioning some of the problems that we face there, because because I think this war has diverted attention from civil rights. It has strengthened the forces of reaction in our country and has brought to the forefront the military-industrial complex that even President Eisenhower warned us against at one time. And above all, it is destroying human lives. It's destroying the lives of thousands of the young, promising men of our nation. Destroying the lives of little boys and little girls in Vietnam. But one of the greatest things that this war is doing to us in civil rights is that it is allowing the great society to be shot down on the battlefields of Vietnam every day. And I submit this afternoon that we can end poverty in the United States. Our nation has the resources to do it. The national gross product of America will rise to the astounding figure of some $780 billion this year. We have the resources. The question is whether our nation has the will. And I submit that if we can spend $35 billion a year to fight an ill-considered war in Vietnam and $20 billion to put a man on the moon, our nation can spend billions of dollars to put God's children on their own 2 feet right here on earth. Let me say another thing that's more in the realm of the spirit, I guess. That is, if we are to go on in the days ahead and make true brotherhood a reality, it is necessary for us to realize more than ever before that the destinies of the Negro and the white man are tied together. Now, there's still a lot of people who don't realize this. The races still don't realize this. But it is a fact now that Negroes and whites are tied together. And we need each other. The Negro needs the white man to save him from his fear. The white man needs the Negro to save him from his guilt. We are tied together in so many ways, our language, our music, our cultural patterns, our material prosperity, and even our food are an amalgam of black and white. And so there can be no separate black path to power and fulfillment that does not intersect white roots. There can be no separate white path to power and fulfillment short of social disaster. It does not recognize the need of sharing that power with black aspirations for freedom and justice. We must come to see now that integration is not merely a romantic or aesthetic something where you merely add color to a still predominantly white power structure. Integration must be seen also on political terms where there is shared power and where black men and white men share power together to build a new and a great nation. In a real sense, we all caught in an inescapable network of mutuality, tied in a single garment of destiny. John Donne placed it years ago in graphic terms, no man is an island in time itself. Every man is a piece of the continent, a part of the main. And he goes on toward the end to say, any man's death diminishes me because I'm involved in mankind. Therefore, never sin to know for whom the bell tolls. It tolls for thee. And so we all in the same situation. The salvation of the Negro will mean the salvation of the white man and the destruction of the life and of the ongoing progress of the Negro will be the destruction of the ongoing progress of the nation. Now let me say finally that we have difficult days ahead, but I haven't despaired. Somehow I maintain hope in spite of hope, and I've talked about the difficulties and how hard the problems will be as we tackle them. But I want to close by saying this afternoon that I still have faith in the future, and I still believe that these problems can be solved. And so I will not join anyone who will say that we still can't develop a coalition of conscience. I realize and understand the discontent and the agony and the disappointment and even the bitterness of those who feel that whites in America cannot be trusted. And I would be the first to say that there are all too many who are still guided by the racist ethos. But I am still convinced there are still many white persons of goodwill, and I'm happy to say that I see them every day in the student generation, who cherish democratic principles and justice above principle, and who will stick with the cause of justice and the cause of civil rights and the cause of peace throughout the days ahead. And so I refuse to despair. I think we are going to achieve our freedom, because however much America strays away from the ideals of justice, the goal of America is freedom. Abused and scorned though we may be, our destiny is tied up in the destiny of America. Before the Pilgrim Fathers landed at Plymouth, we were here. Before Jefferson etched across the pages of history the majestic words of the Declaration of Independence, we were here. Before the beautiful words of the Star-Spangled Banner were written, we were here. And for more than two centuries, our forebears labored here without wages. They made cotton king. They built the homes of their masters in the midst of the most humiliating and oppressive conditions. And yet out of a bottomless vitality, they continued to grow and develop. And I say that if the inexpressible cruelties of slavery couldn't stop us, the opposition that we now face, including the so-called white backlash, will surely fail. We are going to win our freedom because both the sacred heritage of our nation and the eternal will of the Almighty God are embodied in our echoing demands. And so I can still sing, we shall overcome. We shall overcome because the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends toward justice. We shall overcome because Carlyle is right. No lie can live forever. We shall overcome because William Cullen Bryant is right. Truth, crest, earth will rise again. shall overcome because James Russell Lowell is right. Truth forever on the scaffold, wrong forever on the throne. Yet that scaffold sways the future. With this faith, we will be able to hew out of the mounting of despair a stone of hope. With this faith, we will be able to transform the jangling discords of our nation into a beautiful symphony of brotherhood. With this faith, we will be able to speed up the day when all of God's children, black men and white men, Jews and Gentiles, Protestants and Catholics, will be able to join hands and live together as brothers and sisters all over this great nation. That will be a great day. That will be a great tomorrow. In the words of the scripture, to speak symbolically, that will be the day when the morning stars will sing together and the sons of God will shout for joy. Thank you.
The Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., The Other America. This is Earthwatch on the Pacifica Radio Network, originating at WBAI. I'm Robert Knight in New York. And up next, a recent conversation about Dr. King's prophetic insight with Kevin Gray, author of The Decline of Black Politics, From Malcolm X to Barack Obama.
The surprise. Sometimes a man smiles.
I often wonder.
You can tell he's a thinker
by the faraway look in his eyes. The faraway look in his eyes.
A pity for his thoughts could make him richer.
His eyes could see what other eyes could not.
This is 5 o'clock shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network. I'm Robert Knight in New York. And today we consider some of Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s hopes, dreams, and assessments of how far the movement had come at the end of his life. And to
discuss the contemporary implications of the King legacy. We are joined today by Kevin Gray. He is the author of Waiting for Lightning to Strike, The Fundamentals of Black Politics, as well as The Decline of Black Politics from Malcolm X to Barack Obama. Kevin is with us live, joining us from South Carolina. Good afternoon, sir.
Good afternoon. Are you there?
Yes, we are. Can you hear me?
I can hear you.
Well, Kevin, it's always a pleasure and a revelation to have you on because of the critical analytical way in which you approach Black history, the legacy of the Civil Rights Movement, and the contortions of history we find ourselves in today. Why don't we just open up the floor for your assessment of where we have come since 1968?
That's a big question. You know, and I'm working on trying to finish that second book, The Decline of Black Politics, which I've been working on for about 10 years now. I started working on it before Barack Obama became president. And Barack Obama becoming president didn't make it any easier to write that book because it's, you know, you got your first person of color as president and people are saying, well, why do you see a decline? But, you know, when you look at where Dr. King was when he died, being opposed to empire, when he died, you had right about 100 black elected officials. Now you have over 10,000. A lot of people like to talk about the mountaintop speech, the dream speech, but I think that, and the Riverside speech, which was, of course, an important speech. But I always go back to the Other America speech where he talks about black and inner city unemployment. At the time he gave the speech, he was right at 8%. Now it's probably doubled that. You know, and I just finished talking to another friend. I said, if Dr. King were alive today and had the same politics, then a lot of people would be against him because he would, you know, his politics would be the antithesis of what we see coming out the White House and this idea of cheering on empire. So, you know, in a way, Dr. King's martyred life and the fact that we do pause to at least examine his life on his birthday and on his assassination date makes us think about the idea of empire, the idea that our country has been at war almost every 20 years since its existence, the idea that our country is willing to spend money on war but not on health care, that, you know, we're still fighting for justice all around the country. It's not just about one case with Trayvon Martin, but it's about Floyd Davis. It's about Romali Graham. It's about, you know, Oscar Grant. It's about Sean Bell. It's about the folk at the end of a drone in Afghanistan or Pakistan. It's about going to war with Iraq, thinking that with the majority of the American people thinking that Iraq somehow bombed the buildings in New York on 9/11. It's about, you know, still fighting for workers' rights and the right and for human rights and civil rights for poor people, economic rights for poor people, and the need to create another America. Dr. King said America had to be born again, and it hasn't faced that rebirth. Surely, you know, there's diversity in government, but it's diversity that's presiding over the misery that's existed for a lot of people for a long time.
Clarence Thomas is black, but the system remains the same. The speech that you pay particular attention to, not the only one, of course, is the April 4th, 1967 speech given at Riverside Church in New York City, beyond Vietnam. And certainly the empire that you speak of, the military encroachment of the United States on all parts of the globe, the new initiatives in Africa, and the remote control assassination of people. We were speaking earlier and observed that at least Nixon did not assassinate Jane Fonda when she went to Vietnam, but this black president has reserved the right and codified it to do so.
You know, I was watching the news today, and that's one of his talking points that he sent out to all the surrogates in his reelection bid. And we got Osama bin Laden. Now, I listened this morning, I think it was MSNBC. He got Osama bin Laden. They dare not use the word assassinate, but he is the assassination president. And people need to reconcile what that means. You know, what is the difference between a non-judicial assassination the government via the commander-in-chief gave for Osama bin Laden or Alawi, and George Zimmerman summarily executing Trayvon Martin? What is the difference?
You remind us of one of the Reverend Doctor's more famous admonitions about paying attention to the content of one's character rather than the color of the president's skin. The point being that race is no longer a guarantee, if it ever was, of communitarian principles aimed at uplifting the in-group as well as the out-group simultaneously. In that context, there was a great moment, a great coherence among African-American people and people of goodwill across the country. Now that seems much more fragmented, as well as the purpose of a movement.
First of all, we need a left movement in the country. And we need the left, the radical left, the progressive left, to be just as organized and just as vociferous as their so-called radical right, evangelical right. Now, that being said, you know, most people believe that any movement for social justice is going to be led by those who are really affected the most grievously by the injustice of a particular kind of system. And so when you historically look at who America has oppressed, well, Native American and black people. But, you know, as you see with Barack Obama, as you see with this idea of black elected officials and you know, it's folk like to run the empire, and they'll cheer the empire as long as they're running it. It's almost as though the empire said to whoever runs it, you know, if we put these people in charge of their own misery, they'll holler and complain a whole lot less. So, I mean, that's the thing that we're dealing with now. You know, even when you hear people talk about Dr. King's dream is realized through having a black president, well, you know, that's not what Dr. King was about. But that's where a lot of people are. Part of the problem is not having a consistent, coherent left movement in this country. And that's what we need to build. And we need to build it locally, and we need to build it consistently, which is what, you know, you have the Green Party that might do it in fits and starts. In the black community, you've got parachute leadership that will parachute down into your community if you got a problem, and they suck up all the oxygen of the problem, but they're not creating any or all the press that they can get. But there's nothing institutional, there's nothing structural, there's nothing democratic that's being created.
One other thing, Kevin Gray. The movement of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference and SNCC and all of the other civil rights movements spoke about segregation and equal access, but there were so many other issues, including Operation Breadbasket, nutrition, food, education. And has the ball been dropped on the less obvious forms of discrimination in which people are, you know, shunted to neighborhoods that don't have quite the same services or don't have the full digital access and so on? What about the universal needs of the movement?
Well, as I said, the universal needs of the movement, I would think, would be retraining the community or reteaching the community about what a freedom movement is about, which might mean creating freedom schools and a different kind of organizational structure on the local level. Something different from the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, of course, which I got my start in, but you know, something more secular, more democratic, not based on traditional paternalistic male led models. That seems to be the problem that I see in the black community. But then again, you know, how do we deal with exploitation? How do we deal with co-optation? Because a lot of what we see in black political organizations today, organizations that are sponsored by the very people that they claim to fight, that therein lies a big problem with what they stand for. I mean, Wells Fargo supports just about every so-called black organization that's chartered, from NAN to the NAACP to the Rainbow Coalition. And let's just call it like it is. you know, and some of these cats are my friends that I, you know, some of them I even love, but they're co-opted. And, they're not, you know, it's not about the people. It's about getting that big check. And it's about being out front, but it's not about solving any institutional problems or being serious about organizing. And they're going from pillar to post, from issue to issue, or crises to crises without building anything long-lasting.
Well, Kevin Gray, I intend to extend this discussion with you in future days and weeks on the reconstruction of a universal movement that includes racial as well as economic and other forms of equity, and tell people where they can follow your work. Very compelling pieces you've written, including the one, The Decline of Black Politics from Malcolm X to Barack Obama, as well as Waiting for Lightning to Strike, The Fundamentals of Black Politics. Where can people follow you?
Well, you can go to Counterpunch, you can go to Progressive, you can go to my blog, The New Liberator. I think it's at WordPress. And, of course, my stuff is at AK Press, and the Decline of Black Politics is coming out on Verso. And I do a serious satellite radio show every Sunday, live from Land of Hopes and Dreams with Dave Marsh.
Well, thank you so much. And we've been speaking live with Kevin Gray in South Carolina. I'm Robert Knight in New York, and we now take a look at one of the most analytical speeches by the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King, delivered on the 16th of August, 1967. It was his final annual report to the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, where he addressed Operation Breadbasket and the state of the civil rights movement. And yet, despite some advances, King was acutely aware that war, economics, and racism left the American Negro stranded on the road between slavery and injustice. Or as he puts it, we still have a long, long, long way to go before we reached the promised land of freedom. Here now, Dr. King's State of the Black Nation Address of August 16, 1967, titled, Where Do We Go From Here?
With all the struggle and all the achievements, we must face the fact, however, that the Negro still lives in the basement of the great society. He is still at the bottom, despite the few who have penetrated to slightly higher levels. Even where the door has been forced partially open, mobility for the Negro is still sharply restricted. There's often no bottom at which to start, and when there is, there's almost no room at the top. In consequence, Negroes are still impoverished aliens in an affluent society. They are too poor even to rise with the society, too impoverished by the ages to be able to ascend by using their own resources. The Negro did not do this himself. It was done to him. For more than half of his American history, he was enslaved. Yet he built the spanning bridges, the grand mansions, the sturdy docks, and stout factories of the South. His unpaid labor made cotton king and established America as a significant nation in international commerce. Even after his release from chattel slavery, the nation grew over him, submerging him. It became the richest, most powerful society in the history of man. But it left the Negro far behind. And so we still have a long, long way to go before we reach the promised land of freedom. Yes, we have left the dusty soils of Egypt. And we have crossed a Red Sea that had for years been hardened by a long and piercing winter of massive resistance. Before we reach the majestic shores of the Promised Land, there will still be gigantic mountains of opposition ahead and prodigious hilltops of injustice. We still need some Paul Revere of conscience to alert every hamlet and every village of America that revolution is still at hand. Yes, we need a chart. We need a compass. Indeed, we need some North Star to guide us into a future shrouded with impenetrable uncertainties. Now, in order to answer the question, where do we go from here, which is our theme, we must first honestly recognize where we are now. When the Constitution was written, a strange formula to determine taxes and representation declared that the Negro was 60% of a person. Today, another curious formula seems to declare he is 50% of a person. Of the good things in life, the Negro has approximately one half those of whites. Of the bad things of life, he has twice those of whites. Thus, half of all Negroes live in substandard housing. And Negroes have half the income of whites. When we turn to the negative experiences of life, the Negro has a double share. There are twice as many unemployed. The rate of infant mortality among Negroes is double that of whites. There are twice as many Negroes dying in Vietnam as whites in proportion to their size and the population. In other spheres, the figures are equally alarming. In elementary schools, Negroes lag 1 to 3 years behind whites, and their segregated schools receive substantially less money per student than the white schools. 1/20th as many Negroes as whites attend college. Of employed Negroes, 75% hold menial jobs. This is where we are. Where do we go from here? First, we must massively assert our dignity and worth. We must stand up amid a system that still oppresses us and develop an unassailable and majestic sense of values. We must no longer be ashamed of being black. The job of arousing manhood within a people that have been taught for so many centuries that they are nobody is not easy. Even semantics have conspired to make that which is black seem ugly and degrading. In Roget's thesaurus, there are some 120 synonyms for blackness, and at least 60 of them are offensive, such words as blot, sup, grim, devil, and foul. There are some 134 synonyms for whiteness, and all are favorable, expressed in such words as purity, cleanliness, chastity, and innocence. A white lie is better than a black lie. The most degenerate member of a family is the black sheep. Arthur Davis has suggested that maybe the English language should be reconstructed so that teachers will not be forced to teach the Negro child 60 ways to despise himself and thereby perpetuate his false sense of inferiority, and the white child 134 ways to adore himself and thereby perpetuate his false sense of superiority. Tendency to ignore the Negro's contribution to American life and strip him of his personhood is as old as the earliest history books and as contemporary as the morning's newspaper. To offset this cultural homicide, the Negro must rise up with an affirmation of his own Olympian manhood. Any movement for the Negro's freedom that overlooks this necessity is only waiting to be buried. As long as the mind is enslaved, the body can never be free. Psychological freedom, a firm sense of self-esteem, is the most powerful weapon against the long night of physical slavery. No Lincolnian Emancipation Proclamation. No Johnsonian civil rights bill can totally bring this kind of freedom. The Negro will only be free when he reaches down to the inner depths of his own being and signs with the pen and ink of assertive manhood his own emancipation proclamation. With a spirit straining toward true self-esteem, the Negro must boldly throw off the manacles of self-abnegation and say to himself and to the world, I am somebody. I am a person. I am a man with dignity and honor. I have a rich and noble history, however painful and exploited that history has been. Yes, I was a slave through my foreparents. And now I'm not ashamed of that. I'm ashamed of the people who were so sinful to make me a slave. Yes. Yes, we must stand up and say, I'm black, but I'm black and beautiful. This self-affirmation is the black man's need made compelling by the white man's crimes against him. Now another basic challenge is to discover how to organize our strength into economic and political power. And no one can deny that the Negro is in dire need of this kind of legitimate power. Indeed, one of the great problems that the Negro confronts is his lack of power. From the old plantations of the South to the newer ghettos of the North, the Negro has been confined to a life of voicelessness and powerlessness. Stripped of the right to make decisions concerning his life and destiny, he has been subject to the authoritarian and sometimes whimsical decisions of the white power structure. The plantation and the ghetto were created by those who had power, both to confine those who had no power and to perpetuate their powerlessness. Now, the problem of transforming the ghetto, therefore, is a problem of power. Confrontation between the forces of power demanding change and the forces of power dedicated to the preserving of the status quo. Now, power properly understood is nothing but the ability to achieve purpose. It is the strength required to bring about social, political, and economic change. Walter Ruther defined power one day. He said, power is the ability of a labor union like UAW to make the most powerful corporation in the world, General Motors, say yes when it wants to say no. That's power. Now, a lot of us are preachers, and all of us have our moral convictions and concerns, and so often we have problems with power. There is nothing wrong with power. If power is used correctly. You see, what happened is that some of our philosophers got off base. And one of the great problems of history is that the concepts of love and power have usually been contrasted as opposites, polar opposites, so that love is identified with a resignation of power and power with a denial of love. It was this misinterpretation that caused the philosopher Nietzsche, who was a philosopher of the will to power, to reject the Christian concept of love. It was the same misinterpretation which induced Christian theologians to reject Nietzsche's philosophy of the will to power in the name of the Christian idea of love. Now, we got to get this thing right. What is needed is a realization that power without love is reckless and abusive, and that love without power is sentimental and anemic. Power at its best. Power at its best is love, implementing the demands of justice, and justice at its best is love correcting everything that stands against love. And this is what we must see as we move on. Now, what has happened is that we've had it wrong and mixed up in our country. And this has led Negro Americans in the past to seek their goals through love and moral suasion devoid of power, and white Americans to seek their goals through power devoid of love and conscience. It is leading a few extremists today to advocate for Negroes the same destructive and conscienceless power that they have justly abhorred in whites. It is precisely this collision of immoral power with powerless morality which constitutes the major crisis of our time. We must develop progress, or rather the program, and I can't stay on this long, that will drive the nation to a guaranteed annual income. Now, early in the century, this proposal would have been greeted with ridicule and denunciation as destructive of initiative and responsibility. At that time, economic status was considered the measure of the individual's abilities and talents. And in the thinking of that day, the absence of worldly goods indicated a want of industrious habits and moral fiber. We've come a long way in our understanding of human motivation and of the blind operation of our economic system. Now we realize that dislocations in the market operation of our economy and the prevalence of discrimination thrust people into idleness and bind them in constant or frequent unemployment against their will. The poor are less often dismissed, I hope, from our conscience today by being branded as inferior and incompetent. We also know that no matter how dynamically the economy develops and expands, it does not eliminate all poverty. The problem indicates that our emphasis must be twofold. We must create full employment, or we must create incomes. People must be made consumers by one method or the other. Once they are placed in this position, we need to be concerned that the potential of the individual is not wasted. New forms of work that enhance the social good will have to be devised for those for whom traditional jobs are not available. In 1879, Henry George anticipated this state of affairs when he wrote in Progress and Poverty, "The fact is that the work which improves the condition of mankind, the work which extends knowledge and increases power and enriches literature and elevates thought, is not done to secure living. It is not the work of slaves driven to that task, either by the task of that of a taskmaster or by animal necessities. It is the work of men who somehow find a form of work that brings a security for its own sake. In a state of society where want is abolished, work of this sort could be enormously increased. We are likely to find that the problem of housing, education, instead of preceding the elimination of poverty, will themselves be affected if poverty is first abolished. The poor transformed into purchasers will do a great deal on their own to alter housing decay. Negroes who have a double disability will have a greater effect on discrimination when they have the additional weapon of cash to use in their struggle. Beyond these advantages, a host of positive psychological changes inevitably will result from widespread economic security. The dignity of the individual will flourish when the decisions concerning his life are in his own hands, when he has the assurance that his income is stable and certain, and when he knows that he has the means to seek self-improvement. Personal conflicts between husband, wife, and children will diminish when the unjust measurement of human worth on a scale of dollars is eliminated. Now our country can do this. John Kenneth Galbraith said that a guaranteed annual income could be done for about $20 billion a year. And I say to you today, that if our nation can spend $35 billion a year to fight an unjust, evil war in Vietnam and $20 billion to put a man on the moon, it can spend billions of dollars to put God's children on their own 2 feet right here on earth. What is needed is a strategy for change, a tactical program that will bring the Negro into the mainstream of American life as quickly as possible. So far, this has only been offered by the nonviolent movement. Without recognizing this, we will end up with solutions that don't solve, answers that don't answer, and explanations that don't explain. There are 40 million poor people here. One day we must ask the question, why are there 40 million poor people in America? And when you begin to ask that question, you're raising a question about the economic system, about a broader distribution of wealth. When you ask that question, you begin to question the capitalistic economy. And I'm simply saying that more and more, we've got to begin to ask questions about the whole society. We are called upon to help the discouraged beggars in life's marketplace. But one day we must come to see that an edifice which produces beggars needs restructuring. It means that questions must be raised. You see, my friends, when you deal with this, you begin to ask the question, who owns the oil? You begin to ask the question, who owns the iron ore? You begin to ask the question, why is it that people have to pay water bills in a world that's two-thirds water? Now, when I say question in the whole society, it means ultimately coming to see that the problem of racism, the problem of economic exploitation, and the problem of war all tied together. These are the triple evils that are interrelated. If you will let me be a preacher just a little bit. One night a juror came to Jesus. And he wanted to know what he could do to be saved. Jesus didn't get bogged down on the kind of isolated approach of what you shouldn't do. Jesus didn't say, now Nicodemus, you must stop lying. He didn't say, Nicodemus, now you must not commit adultery. He didn't say, now Nicodemus, you must stop cheating if you're doing that. He didn't say, Nicodemus, you must stop drinking liquor if you're doing that excessively. He said something altogether different because Jesus realized something basic. That if a man will lie, he will steal. And if a man will steal, he will kill. So instead of just getting bogged down on one thing, Jesus looked at him and said, Nicodemus, you must be born again. In other words, your whole structure must be changed. A nation that will keep people in slavery for 244 years will thingify them and make them things. And therefore, they will exploit them and poor people generally, economically. And a nation that will exploit economically will have to have foreign investments and everything else, and it will have to use its military might to protect them. All of these problems are tied together. What I'm saying today is that we must go from this convention and say, America, you must be born again. so I conclude by saying today that we have a task, and let us go out with a divine dissatisfaction. Let us be dissatisfied until America will no longer have a high blood pressure of creeds and an anemia of deeds. The roll ahead will not always be smooth. There will still be rocket paces of frustration and meandering points of bewilderment. There will be inevitable setbacks here and there. There will be those moments when the buoyancy of hope will be transformed into the fatigue of despair. Our dreams will sometime be shattered, and our ethereal hopes blasted. We may again, with tear-drenched eyes, have to stand before the bier of some courageous civil rights worker whose life will be snuffed out by the dastardly acts of bloodthirsty mobs. But difficult and painful as it is, we must walk on in the days ahead with an audacious faith in the future. And as we continue our chartered course, we may gain consolation from the words so nobly left by that great Black Bart, who was also a great freedom fighter of yesterday, James Weldon Johnson. Yeah. Stony the road we trod, yeah. Bitter the chastening rod felt in the days when hope unborn had died. Yeah. Yet with a steady beat have not our weary feet come to the place for which our father sighed. We have come over the way that with tears has been watered. We have come treading our path through the blood of the slaughter, out from the gloomy past, till now we stand at last, where the bright gleam of our bright star is cast. Let this affirmation be our ringing cry. It will give us the courage to face the uncertainties of the future. It will give our tired feet new strength as we continue our forward stride toward the city of freedom. When our days become dreary with low hovering clouds of despair, when our nights become darker than a thousand midnights, let us remember that there is a creative force in this universe working to pull down the gigantic mountains of evil. A power that is able to make a way out of no way and transform dark yesterdays into bright tomorrows. Let us realize that the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends toward justice. Let us realize that William Cullen Bryant is right. Truth crushed to earth will rise again. Let us go out realizing that the Bible is right. Be not deceived. God is not mocked. Whatsoever a man soweth, that shall he also reap. This is our hope for the future. And with this faith, we will be able to sing in some not too distant tomorrow with a cosmic past tense. We have overcome. We have overcome. Deep in my heart, I did believe we would overcome.
Hey, I just got back from another world. It was way, way past another side. It was across the mountain and through the seas, past the moon, beyond all things that we've dreamed about. You never in your life seen such color that glows like a twinkle in an eye. Like little things with velvet ring and budding trees that summer bring back to life again. Oh, I didn't want to leave, 'cause I was having such a good time. But as we go through life, the good times, they seem to end. Wow, 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 wow.
Listening to Earth Watch on the Pacifica Radio Network, originating at WBAI. I'm Robert Knight in New York. And that concludes today's special celebration of the 85th anniversary of the birth of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. We welcome your comments and insights with an email to rknight@wbai.org. That's R-K-N-I-G-H-T at wbai.org. And for Earthwatch, I'm Robert Knight in New York.
Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. My name's Jim Freund. Okay, so MLK was 85 years ago. Power of the Wolf was, about 42, 43 years ago. And Alfred Bester was 100 years ago. Stay tuned. Good morning. As mentioned, this is Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. And this will be an anniversary show, I guess. We do not know. It's January 16th. We do not know exactly what date Margot Adler began Hour of the Wolf. It would have been 42 years ago. But it was January. It was late January of 1972. And I took over the show about 2 years later. I was her co-host. She did the show 5 days a week because, well, she has 10 hours a week at minimum worth listening to. More than that, but 10 hours a week, 5 days a week, 2 hours a day is what we had. And I was her co-host on Thursdays and Fridays, and frequently engineer at other times. By the way, Margot will be here sometime in February to discuss her brand new book called Vampires Are Us. The actual pub date is March 1st, to be precise, but it'll be out a little bit earlier. So before we get to the show. Announcements. Okay, let's see. Well, unless you've got a TARDIS, I'm afraid you just missed the KGB Fantastic Fiction reading tonight, but I have no doubt it'll be a good one. Gordon Linsner recorded it for us, and we may very well hear it at some point in the near future. In a couple of weeks, the New York Review of Science Fiction, February 4th, to be precise, will be featuring D.T. Friedman and Nancy Hightower. If you were listening, about 3 months ago now, D.T. Friedman, Dr. Danielle Friedman, was here and read a story that absolutely floored me. And next week, Nancy Hightower will be here, so you will learn more about her. So that will be at the Soho Gallery for Digital Art, or Soho Art Space, as it is sometimes known. February 4th, Tuesday, doors open at 6:30. Admission is free. Donations are accepted for the event. Now, the Soho Gallery for Digital Art is also changing its nature. It's not just a place for events anymore. it is beginning. There's this sort of floating artisan market that has been going on for a while. I looked it up when the owner of the gallery, John Ordover, told me about it. And this floating gallery is going to be floating in to that very same space, Lala's Artisan Market. It is called, and they are going to be in that same space where we are on the first Tuesdays at 138 Sullivan Street on Thursdays, Fridays, Saturdays, and Sundays. So for more information, go to Facebook and look up Gallery Lala, and that will tell you more. So I think that does the announcements. Alfred Bester. Alfie Bester is a person who was on this program several times in the 1970s. I should have looked up his exact particulars. In fact, I think, while as I am talking to you, I'm going to dare to turn around. Pardon my mic move here. And seek it out. In December, as of December, Alfie turned 100 years old. He passed away some time back, but, you know, as they say, as you heard Robert Knight saying, and this is a phrase that I always hear people using nowadays, the anniversary of a person's birth. Come on. It's their birthday, you know, even if they've passed, that's their birthday. Okay, so let's see. Googling up Alfie Bester, Alfred Bester. Yeah, he died in 1987. One of my proudest moments on Hour of the Wolf and Barry Malzberg, who was a regular on this program every September until the show was moved to Wednesdays. When it was on Saturdays, he was our regular. One of my great joys on this program was Alfred coming in, and he was this dapper gent. He had been the head writer of The Shadow, as in, yes, who knows what lurks in the hearts and minds of men for any number of years. He is the person who on Green Lantern came up with, oh, whatever that poem was, you know, no hail or sleet will stop this Green Lantern from joining the planetary saviors, stuff like that. He was born December 18th, 1913, okay? So that gives us, you know, 100 years and a month. Died September 30th, 1987. I guess he was on this show about five or six times. There was one time that Alfie came in. All sails to the wind, if you follow me. And he had been playing host to Brian W. Aldiss, one of the great science fiction writers. And it was a Saturday night after midnight. Mickey Waldman was on the air. Not that Alfie would know from, you know, a particular night. He just knew where the WBAI church, and yes, we were in a church in those days on East 62nd Street. He knew where it was. About 1 a.m., I was asleep in the balcony of the church. I lived there, I think is probably the term we are looking for. And he buzzes the door, bangs on the door, but mostly buzzes. Now, I'm asleep. Mickey Waldman, who was herself well-versed in science fiction, although that was not the scope of her show, although she would occasionally just decide to read a